Welcome back to Word Up with Dani Katz. I am your host, Dani Katz. I am an author, journalist, and a quantum languaging coach and consultant. What that means is that I teach people how language programs consciousness, how language programs reality at large, and how to transform reality and evolve our consciousness with language. I've also been known to cultivate and share an opinion or two or 12 about culture and consciousness and how they are evolving, devolving, and being manipulated by the powers that were. Here at Word Up, we are devoted to fostering critical thinking while supporting you in becoming your most authentic, empowered, liberated, realized, amazing version of yourself. Our every show aims to expand your consciousness, raise your frequency, sharpen your critical thinking skills, and make you giggle. And think. Given the radical uptick in censorship over the past few years, combined with the complete co-opting slash decimation of my own personal industry, journalism, I started Word Up to have a free speech-friendly platform in which to engage exploratory, solutions-based conversations with visionaries, mystics, original thinkers, and rebel badasses who are helping to make the world more wonderful. The first half of my interviews run between 30 to 90 minutes and are always posted here for free public listening. The second halves are reserved for paid supporters on my Patreon and my Locals platforms, where for as little as $5 a month, you can access all of my second half conversations along with oodles of other bonus content and opportunities to drop in with me, to drop in with our High Vibe tribe, and lots of other awesome things. In addition to interviews, Word Up also features quantum languaging upgrades, planetary service announcements, and propaganda analysis, which I call Spot the Propaganda. Thank you so much for tuning in and for sharing your sacred attention with me and our High Vibe tribe of change makers. Be sure to click that subscribe button so you can stay abreast of our every episode. Thank you for also clicking the like button, for sharing far and wide, and for leaving some kind words as a review as you are authentically inspired. As well, if you are gleaning any value whatsoever from these shows, consider supporting me on Locals and or Patreon. And as you are wanting to learn more about my quantum languaging coaching and consulting services or nab copies of my books, find me on DaniKatz.com as well as on quantumlanguaging.com. Okay, I think that's it for our housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy this episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Well, hello, superstars. Welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Dani Katz. Today, I am joined by myself because we're solo podcasting. We're going to go over wrong use of will languaging. And I have a few different examples because it's just come up so many times over the past week. It seemed like the perfect opportunity to talk about it. And I'm just getting back in town from Texas, where I was at Confluence, which was amazing. So there are a couple kind of lingering pieces. So we're going to jump around a little bit. I want to start off by acknowledging, and I know this isn't like top of news cycle right now. I'm recording this on Sunday the 14th. It's going to drop Wednesday the 17th. And I just want to give my two cents about the Candace Owens, her getting fired from Ben Shapiro's company. And I know there's like all of this hullabaloo in the, what would it be, alt media community. I mean, it's such a, it's such a reach to call these people alt media figures. And I just want to let it be known that I don't think this is a matter of censorship. I think it's dumb. I think the whole thing is a giant distraction. I don't know how organic the whole
her being let go was. I don't have any inside knowledge, but it seems like such a massive distraction when we really have infinitely more important things to talk about. And as a journalist, who's been silenced by a lot of different outlets, I don't consider this censorship of Ben Shapiro deciding to fire her for, like, who knows? I don't even know if there's been a public statement, if it was because she said Jesus is king or for being critical of Israel. I actually agree with Ben Shapiro on this, that he doesn't have to pay someone to espouse ideas with which he does not agree. This has happened to me so many times in my career, whether it was at the LA Weekly or at Reality Sandwich or Santa Fe Reporter, it's par for the course. So, as I understand it, and I'm not going to waste our time looking it up because I don't think it's really all that interesting, but censorship would be if, like, the government was pressuring a publisher or a platform to not put out certain information, like we saw under COVID, and we had institutions like Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and Twitter silencing people because of the pressure they were getting from the government. That is what we call censorship. But a specific show or organization deciding that they don't want to work with someone anymore because of her ideas, I think that's just capitalism at this point. And I wouldn't call that censorship. Do I think it's hypocritical for people like Dave Rubin and Ben Shapiro, who were so vocal about the silencing of perspectives when it comes to the woke stuff, now silencing people because of their perspectives on Israel? Absolutely. I think that is absolutely hypocritical, but I don't think this counts as censorship. I think it's a misuse of this term. And I think what it does is it undermines the validity of actual censorship, like every strike I've gotten on YouTube, every posting that's been deleted from Instagram. That to me feels a lot closer to censorship than Ben Shapiro deciding that he doesn't want to pay Candace Owens to have these ridiculous shows with Rabbi Shmuley or the other rabbi or whatnot. Again, I don't know any of these people. I think it's all a giant distraction, but I just want to go on the record saying, I don't really think this is censorship, and I think it's dangerous to the larger censorship conversation to attempt to lump this in. Just my two cents. I also want to talk to us about the concept of ad hominems by way of my illustrated guide to propaganda, which, if you have not picked up this book for your teens or yourself, I recommend running, not walking, to Amazon to get yourself copies, if you're not down with buying books on Amazon. And it's really important right now that we educate ourselves on these tools of division, of media manipulation, of persuasion, such that we're not taking the bait. And I had my own experience of this. I have been working with a publicist who's fantastic in getting my new book, The Language of Betterarchy, out to a larger audience. One of the primary issues I'm having is that so many of us have bought into this engineered divide. And so it's made placing my book in bookstores or in, magazines that gave me publicity for my last books, it's made it infinitely harder because these people are confused, have bought into the divide. So I'll just give you a couple examples. It approached Collected Works, who they're probably like our biggest, most established bookstore, and they host readings and they host local authors. So I was super, super excited to not just place my new book, The Language of Betterarchy, in their store, but to also host a reading. Like, I haven't had a proper reading for any of my books. It just hasn't been how I've rolled. But I really wanted to have one for The Language of Betterarchy. So this store, Collected Works, has sold Word Up, Little Languaging Hacks for Big Change, has sold Pop Propaganda and Illustrated Guides. So for me, it seemed like a no-brainer. So when I reached out to them, they said, no, we don't look any books at any books anymore. Please don't bring by any copies of your book. We'll just look it up online. So they ignored me for quite a while. And when I finally was able to get the owner on the line to follow up, she's like, no, we're not going to be able to sell your book here. And I said, okay, well, may I ask why, since you've sold my other books there? And she's like, well, my staff just told me not to. They said we're full on illustrated books. And I said, okay, but this isn't an illustrated book. This is a book that has illustrations, but it would more logically live in your linguistics section, sociology section, mass psychology section, communication. And she's like, no, they just told me no. So that was that. Then I'd reached out to other magazines who had given me publicity for my other books and just got completely ghosted, including LA Yoga, who I wrote for years, and they just don't acknowledge me anymore. So to show up for the Language of Betterarchy, I hired a publicist. The publicist has been placing me on these right-wing talk shows, and I've told him a number of times, like, I'm not really right-wing. My book isn't necessarily a right-wing thing. It's actually a tool for all of us, and he's willing to rep my book. This is what we're dealing with now. So it's been a little bit tricky as I'm put on these right-wing talk shows, and then the hosts try to, like, get me to slag the left, right? And the setup is for me to talk about how the left is manipulating language, how the left is propagandizing the public. And every time, you know, I do my best to be diplomatic, and I'm like, actually, it's the left and the right who are doing the same thing, and then get pushback from the host because I'm not aligning myself with one side. So it's been in the back of my mind, like, I don't know if this is really the right path for me because I don't buy into these divides, and it ends up getting, like, mildly contentious with these hosts. So I had been booked on a show on Friday to talk about the weaponization of the terms anti-Semite and anti-Semitic in terms of being these smokescreens that prevent intelligent critical discourse around America's relationships with Israel on the political front. So I'm invited onto this show. The host introduced me, and he just kind of gives me the stage, like, what's your take on how this term is being misused? So I gave him my take on how the term is being misused, and it's a way to shut down any criticism of American policy as regards Israel or anyone else who's, you know, operating in shady ways, but is able to, like, be shielded by this completely misused anti-Semitic term. I wasn't expecting it, but the host went, like, stage 12 meltdown and starts screaming, like, all caps screaming at me at the top of his lungs. So first he calls me a Palestinian, and I'm like, excuse me, sir, I'm a Jewish American woman. Like, I don't have any Palestinian ties. And he's like, no, you're a pro-Palestinian. And I was explaining, like, I'm not actually pro or anti anything. I don't have a dog in this fight at all. And he's like, well, you just claim to be an expert on Israel. And I'm like, no, I actually didn't make any claims to be an expert. I'm certainly not an expert. I just gave you my perspective. And then he's like, well, as a communications consultant, you're terrible at your job. And I'm like, okay, well, see, this is a pitch perfect example of, like, ad hominems being used to shut down conversation, and you're using a lot of, like, second person accusatory you statements, which has me feeling not super safe to have this conversation. So I kept trying to use his stage 12 meltdown as a teaching tool for his audience, but he kept cutting me off and insulting me. So I did decide after that conversation, well, I'm like, I don't really want to do these right-wing talk shows anymore, not because of, you know, any fault of my publicist per se, but just realizing, like, the landscape is so toxic right now, and it's not fun for me. I don't think these people are able to hear me through the mind control, through the confusion. And it did seem like a perfect opportunity to educate us on the ad hominem and what an ad hominem actually is, because that whole conversation turned into a giant ad hominem. So I'm going to read to us the ad hominem entry from my Pop Propaganda and Illustrated Guide. And if you're watching with your eyes, you can see the cute illustration accompanying the entry. Okay, so reading from Pop Propaganda, the ad hominem is a strategy wherein, instead of addressing or challenging the ideas someone espouses, the propagandist, or the person he is propping up, will attack their character or some unrelated behavior. Indicative of having zero proverbial legs to stand on, ad hominems are employed to deflect, distract and dehumanize by attacking a person instead of confronting the ideas or behavior in question. Projecting ill intent is a commonly employed ad hominem tactic wherein the person doing the deflecting, aka he who is working with or for the cultural engineer, whether he knows it or not, alleges to be a psychic mind reader while claiming the person whom he is ad hominem-ing, yes, it's a verb, had nefarious or unsavory intentions. Now, the instance I just mentioned on the radio show, the host was not necessarily projecting ill intent upon me, but it is something we see a lot in the landscape. And I'll give you another example. Pause for sip. Always good to take pauses and to hydrate. It always amazes me when I do podcasts with people who don't have a glass of water on hand, or when I'm out in the world and people aren't carrying their own water bottle. And I'm like, how are you not thirsty? How are you not hydrating throughout the day? I'm used to it at this point. So my friend Eric is very vocal in the no virus conversation and has done a lot of great reporting as a journalist in lending legitimacy to the notion that the viruses don't exist, have never been isolated. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a virologist. I have no expertise in this area. What I do know from my own research is that viruses, or specifically the COVID-19 virus, has never been isolated or proven to exist. The virus, no virus conversation really created a drastic split in the health freedom community that has a lot of people not talking to one another, talking shit about one another, broke up friendships, et cetera, et cetera. My friend Eric is very, very passionate about his no virus stance, and he's taken issue with other people who have been reflecting similar ideas about the virus, who have also shown up at events wherein people are questioning the shape of the planet. Now, you know, as well as I do, how damaging labels are and how they serve to demonize and dehumanize and put people in boxes. So I'm not really a fan of the phrase flat earther. And even just the flat earth has been so weaponized in the larger public discourse that I prefer to sidestep that by just talking about people who are questioning the shape of the planet. And I found it really surprising when my friend Eric was on my podcast and he was attacking viciously people who were questioning the shape of the planet, but who were also on his same page around the virus. But because they were questioning the shape of the planet, he created this giant division, went into ad hominem-ing by accusing them of attempting to sabotage the no virus conversation. And I poked at it when I had him on my podcast saying, like, isn't that a little narcissistic to assume that you and your movement or your larger tribe of questioning, isn't it a little narcissistic to assume that these people have nefarious intentions and aren't questioning the shape of the planet because of their own authentic misgivings around the shape of the planet or their own authentic curiosity around the conversation, but for you to project on them not just ill intent, but ill intent aimed directly at sabotaging you and your colleagues. He didn't quite grok what I was saying. He didn't soften up on that, but it's another example of how the ad hominems work in terms of projecting ill intent upon people who are entertaining conversations we ourselves aren't entertaining, and thereby conflating their authentic inquiry as a deliberate self-sabotaging of a separate conversation. So I'm seeing this all over the place, wherein instead of discussing ideas or perspectives, we leap to insulting one another. I've seen this, you know, myself being accused of being pro-genocide, being accused of being pro-Palestine, anti-Palestine, pro-Israel, anti-Israel, a Nazi, you know, conspiracy theorists, whatever it is, versus like, how about we just talk about the data I'm presenting and talking about the issues at hand? Seems a lot easier for people to default to this Low vibe ad hominem. So now that homonyming. So now that you and me and all of us are attuned to what that word means, just being aware of it in the larger cultural political discourse, how often people will stoop to the ad hominem when they don't actually have any legit information to bring to the actual conversation at hand. All right, I want to get that part out of the way before moving on to wrong use of will languaging. So I wrote the book, The Language of Betterarchy, as a toolkit full of actual tools that we can use to help evolve our culture out of hierarchy and into what I'm calling betterarchy, which is really a placeholder for whatever the next up-leveled iteration of our culture is going to be. As I go into in the book, I'm not a cultural engineer. I'm not a cultural architect. So I don't know what that next iteration is going to be. I'm just calling it betterarchy for now. What I do know is that hierarchy, as an organizational structure that is based on status and privilege, is really not doing us any favors. It seems like we, as American citizens, have outgrown the usefulness of hierarchy, which is dependent upon a class or multiple classes of losers for there to be winners. If we are dependent upon ghettos, upon orphans, upon, you know, countries who are, you know, operating in positions of lack to prop up other, you know, cultures or groups or countries that are operating in abundance, then that's a lame system. And it's time for us to look at how can we reorganize society wherein we're creating win-win solutions for the greatest possible good, right? That's the vision that I'm holding. And that's why I wrote this book, to give us, A, clue us into the markers of hierarchical languaging, and B, to give us tools to upgrade our language out of hierarchical languaging so that we, as citizens, as participants, as co-creators of this collective reality construct, can take agency and empower ourselves to evolve our culture into the next level out of hierarchy. And so in this book, I've pinpointed the 10 markers of hierarchical languaging to help us more easily clue in to when we or people around us are speaking hierarchy. And one of those categories is what is called wrong use of will languaging. Now, right and wrong are polarities. And I do write about the inefficacies of polarities in the book. But what it is, it's a send-up. It's my honoring of the Right Use of Will book series and all that I've learned from it, and then just, you know, inverting it into wrong use of will as a means for us to recognize when false power is being spoken, is being imposed upon us as individuals and as a collective. So what is right use of will? Great question. In addition to being an incredible channeled book, channeled by C.M. de Rohan here in New Mexico, I consider it, and it's a series, right? So it's operating on a lot of levels. But what I got primarily from the first Right Use of Will book is correct third chakra engaging. Like, and when I say correct, again, not in a subjective human way, but you know, the Right Use of Will series is allegedly channeled from the Most High, right? From Source itself, not an archangel, not an intermediary, not an extra dimensional collective like the Nine, but supposedly from Sky Daddy himself. And according to Sky Daddy himself, through the Right Use of Will book series, it is never, ever, ever okay for us to impose our will upon other people. What do I mean by imposing our will upon other people? Telling other people what to do, telling other people what they are allowed to say, what they're not allowed to say, physically laying hands on another person, imposing a medical intervention on someone else without their consent, asking someone else to adjust their behavior to make me more comfortable. That is me stepping outside of my lane and engaging what I am calling wrong use of will. Now, of course, when we're dealing with children for whom we're responsible, this is a different ballgame. If you have a toddler running out into a busy street, you're going to grab that toddler. You're not going to be like, oh, wrong use of will to not lay hands. No. When we're dealing with children, when we're responsible for children, it's different. But when we're dealing with autonomous adults, it is never, ever, ever okay for us to impose our will upon them. So I want to read us a little bit about wrong use of will, just so we're all have a clear understanding as to what I'm referencing. And then I'm going to go into some examples of wrong use of will that I experienced over the past few weeks. All right, I'm going to start at the beginning of the wrong use of will chapter of The Language of Betterarchy. This category of hierarchical languaging was inspired by one of my very favorite books, Right Use of Will, by Cianne de Rohan. Among other things, the book examines the various ways we humans misuse our will by attempting to impose it upon others. The work invites us to take responsibility for our own responses, reactions, and emotions while honoring others' freedom, agency, and authority. Hierarchy loves to impose its will upon the populace and to attempt to deny our free will, sovereignty, and God-given agency over our own lives. Hierarchy is rife with wrong use of will. It tells us we can't drive a car without a license, cut another person's hair without a certificate, build a home without a permit, breed without registering our children as chattel, or expand our consciousness as authentically inspired by ingesting certain plants that grow naturally from the earth. Hierarchy loves to tell us what we can and cannot do. This is one of the more glaring ways in which the masculine shadow has seeped its way into the culture, where it continues to overexert itself, clear, cancel, delete, where it has historically been overexerting itself by controlling and dominating through wrong use of will. So I just want to stop myself here. I do have these clear, cancel, deletes throughout the book as a means of demonstrating hierarchical languaging and giving us in real time the upgrades, right? To just get us in the practice of recognizing when we've spoken hierarchy into the field, utilizing the clear, cancel, delete tool to clear the slate, and then to restate the upgrade in real time. I also talk about a lot in the first part of the book about our misunderstanding of masculine, feminine, the return of the divine feminine. So this is just picking up on what I go deeper into in part one of the book. The truth of the matter is that no one, I repeat, no one has the right to impose his or her will upon anyone else. This applies to laying hands on others and to telling folks what to do, what to believe, and what they are or are not allowed to say, read, write, and think. This also applies to coercion and manipulation tactics that would sway folks into making choices that run counter to their best interests and their authentic desires. Wrong use of will is inherently hierarchical, as it implies that an external entity has authority over us, whether the entity be an agency, organization, or embodied person, or a nebulous, unspecified abstraction, e.g., hope. And there is a very cute, if I do say so myself, illustration of hierarchy having power over someone and just utilizing that as another visual cue to help us recognize hierarchical languaging. It says, we'll dive deeper into the specifics in a moment. Just know that this class of languaging is characterized by a misuse of will, which, when wielded, disempowers our audience as well as ourselves while inspiring contraction and pushback in the process. And the examples that I'm about to share definitely inspired pushback in me. All right, so wrong use of will languaging, just to give us an little perspective on how this specifically applies to the words that we think, type, write, text, all of those things. Wrong use of will languaging describes hierarchical words and languaging strategies that insinuate the imposition of our will upon others, whether overtly or inadvertently. In addition to being fundamentally out of integrity, wrong use of will languaging inspires amygdala freakouts and contractions galore, while fostering imbalanced power dynamics in our relationships and our culture, as well as all the inequality, resentment, and low vibe ickiness that come along with them. Wrong use of will seeps into our languaging habits in the most nuanced and insidious of ways. And while the majority of these communication patterns are unconscious and unintended, the consequences of their bandying are in no way tempered by the ignorance informing them. One of the primary issues with wrong use of will languaging is that it inspires contraction in whomever we are addressing. The coding transmitted to those on the receiving end of wrong use of will frequencies indicates that they're in a lesser status position, right? So think lesser status position. So if I'm using wrong use of will languaging, I'm placing myself up here. And for those listening with our ears, I'm placing myself above the person I'm addressing, who I'm expecting to take an inferior role when I'm using wrong use of will languaging. The coding transmitted to those on the receiving end of wrong use of will frequencies indicates that they're in a lesser status position and that the person who is addressing them is trying to control or dominate them. Whether conscious or not, this coding directs our neurochemistry to armor up and defend, which renders us deaf to the real deal meat of the messages being delivered. As such, our wisest move as conscious communicators and empowered betterarchical reality creators is to transmute any and all wrong use of will languaging patterns into their right use variety, wherein we are honoring the sovereign agency of our audience and whomever we are addressing. So I'm going to get into the polarity pickle in a little bit, but I really just want to stick with wrong use of will languaging right now. So as I explain in the book, and it's kind of like basic background for understanding the language of betterarchy and my whole quantum languaging paradigm, is that we all have these things called amygdalas, right? The amygdala, which is at the base of the brain, is also sometimes called the lizard brain. And the amygdala is very, very old. It's left over from caveman days, when we would see a saber-toothed tiger and the body would immediately be flooded with neurochemicals thanks to the amygdala being activated, right? And so once those fight or flight chemicals are flooding our body, we're in fight mode, right? We're in defense mode. So what does that mean? It means we armor up. Emotionally, we prepare ourselves for battle, and either we run away thinking we're going to be chased by a saber-toothed tiger, or we fight to defend ourselves, defend our tribe. Now, the amygdala being left over from so long ago, it can't really differentiate between the imaginary fear of a saber-toothed tiger attack or the immediate fear of being told you should do X, Y, Z, which is gonna trigger that same amygdala wherein the subconscious mind is like, oh, someone's trying to tell me what to do. Someone is trying to exert their will over me. So it has the exact same response. The amygdala floods the body with fight or flight hormones, and there's no saber-toothed tiger to be found. We're not really going to fight to the death, but what do? We armor up, we get defensive, and now the conversation has turned into an argument because of the amygdala flood that wrong use of will languaging just inspired. And remember, all of this is happening on a subconscious level, but I've examined so many conversations that have turned into arguments, right? And when I'm looking for like, what was that moment where it switched? That moment is when the amygdala was activated, either by separation language, either by wrong use of will language. Several categories are tied in with amygdala hijack. But once the amygdala is hijacked, not only is the body flooded with fight or flight hormones that are signaling we're in danger, armor up, and turning it into a fight. But it also narrows our field of vision, where we no longer have access to our full neural capabilities. So in the instance of, say, you know, the amygdala being activated because of mainstream news is telling me that there's, you know, a terrifying plandemic, or there's a mass murderer loose, right? So duly activated into fight or flight mode because my amygdala has been hijacked from fear programming, I'm not going to have access to every possible solution available, because once the amygdala is activated, the field of possibility that our neurology can access becomes extremely narrowed. So let's say there were 20 potential solutions to an issue. When I'm under amygdala hijack, I'm only going to see like one or two, right? And that's when, and this is why the social engineers use fear as much as they do, why fear itself is absolutely a propaganda strategy, is because once you've persuaded the masses into an amygdala hijack state, they're more easily and more quickly going to grab whatever enslavement solution daddy government is tossing our way, be it, you know, an injection, a face covering, a CBDC, a digital passport, a TSA, a Patriot Act, right? None of those would have been embraced by the public if the public hadn't already been propagandized into an amygdala hijacked fear state that had them just reaching for any solution to quell the terror that had been activated by the mainstream media machine, the propagandists, and the social engineers, right? So we can kind of start to understand how this whole operation is functioning. So even me, and I would say at this point, especially me, it's kind of this interesting phase that I'm in with my own languaging work. And I know other people who've worked with me for a long time have said similar things, where I am so attuned to wrong use of will languaging that I think I have a stronger contraction response to it because I'm recognizing it on such a big level. Whether the person who is speaking wrong use of will frequencies is intending to impose their will upon me or not, for me, the amygdala hijacks get bigger. The urge to armor gets bigger because I'm so hyper aware of this false power being thrust upon me. So I want to give us a couple examples where I saw this in the past couple weeks, just so we can start to understand like some of the more subtle, nuanced ways wrong use of will languaging can slip in to like an average everyday discourse, and the speaker won't even realize the extent to which they're shutting down their audience or whomever they're addressing. So, sharing my screen now. This is a comment that someone posted on a live stream that Emily and I did last week. And this woman, I assume she's a woman because her profile picture is female, but it might not be her at all. It really doesn't matter. Emily, I love you and love your podcast, but I have a simple request if you can. Can you please try and stop using the word like so often? It becomes cringy. Sent with much love. So because we're doing, you know, this is a longer podcast, I'm going to take advantage of the time we have together to break down all of the self-sabotaging frequencies in these three sentences. So number one, and I do want to give the person, she probably does not watch my podcast, because if she did, I think she would have worded this differently, but I want to give her props because she did implement a strategy that I recommend. My therapist has been known to call the poop sandwich, wherein she's offering criticism that might not be taken well. And so she very smartly starts it off the feedback with a compliment and ends it with not necessarily a compliment, but that sent with much love, right? So this is a very smart strategy that I do recommend. Start with a compliment or something nice so that whomever you're addressing feels safe, feels seen, feels appreciated. Then drop in the critique and then finish it off with more kindness, right? It's a great strategy to encourage people to be able to absorb and receive the criticism we're offering. one place where I would offer a criticism to this person is she didn't ask permission, and I didn't hear Emily asking people for feedback on her speech patterns. So obviously this is a comment that was just put on a podcast. And if you're talking to someone in person and you're offering unsolicited feedback, I definitely recommend asking for permission first. Hey, are you open to some feedback on your podcast, right? And then if there's a yes, go for it. If there's a no, don't. But if there's a yes, this is a great strategy of this poop sandwich. So then she says, Emily, I love you and love your podcast, but... Right. So I write about the word but and how it's coded in both the language of Betterarchy as well as WordUp, where the way the subconscious mind receives the word but is it negates everything that came before it. So when she says, Emily, I love you and love your podcast, but she's just like all the time she put into typing, Emily, I love you and love your podcast is completely eradicated. It's erased from Emily's subconscious mind when the but is placed there. So smarter in this instance would be, Emily, I love you and love your podcast, and I have a simple request. But she's not in a place to request at all. This is completely wrong use of will, and she has absolutely no right to make any requests of Emily. Now, if she knew Emily personally, which she might, and if she and Emily had the type of friendship and the type of commitment between them where they were open to making requests of one another as a means of strengthening their relationship moving forward, that's different, right? There are certain relationships we have, especially with family, primary partners, people we're collaborating with on the regular, where we are well served by working on our relationships and making requests. This is not one of those scenarios, and she really doesn't have a leg to stand on. So then she moves into, can you please try and stop using the word like so often? It becomes cringy. Okay, so this woman is having a hard time in her nervous system, in her brain, like whatever it is, receiving how often Emily uses the word like. This is not an Emily problem. This is a MTL 13 QCCA problem. This is her problem. If Emily had said, hey, I'm looking to level up my speech patterns, I'm, you know, committed to letting go of the verbal tick that is like, then this would be fair game. It probably still wouldn't be fair game because this woman has no leg to stand on to ask Emily to adjust her behavior. Also, just want to acknowledge, I am someone who definitely overuses the like tick as a filler. And as Emily responded, and I didn't include that here, both Emily and I were raised in the San Fernando Valley in the 80s, so we come by our likes very honestly. It's definitely a regional tick. And I understand that it can be annoying, right? And I understand, I wrote about this in my first book, Word Up Little Languaging Hacks for Big Change, that these are tells that indicate unconsciousness. They indicate what we're checking out, right? So I myself would be wise to relinquish the word like, and I'm acknowledging that this hits a little too close to home for me, right? So I'm acknowledging, yeah, there's a personal self-consciousness that I'm projecting onto this because I have the same issue. So I'm taking ownership there, but nothing's black and white, right? Like, we live in a multidimensional multiverse. So she really crosses the line in asking Emily to adjust her speech patterns to appease MTL 13 QCCA's contracted comfort zone. Completely not okay. So for me and Emily, you know, Emily doesn't have the triggers on this that I have, but this pissed me off, right? And it was just like, bitch, you're out of line. Like, this is not okay. Stay in your lane. But then she moves into, and clear, cancel, delete. It's not cool for me to call her a bitch, but I am being real with how this lands. And this is the unfortunate side effect of wrong use of will languaging, is it inspires people to shut down our hearts and to not like us very much, right? Like, in terms of me saying, you know, bitch, back off, wrong use of will languaging is going to inspire those types of responses in people. It's a great way to make enemies and to have people not like us, to erroneously and recklessly impose our will upon others. But then she goes into, it becomes cringy. It becomes cringy. And it's like, oh, no, 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 no. Like, so the issue with it becomes cringy is MTL 13 is now projecting her own judgment of Emily's speech pattern and conflating it with objective reality. So she's taking her personal opinion, I find it cringy, and she's conflating it with an objective assessment of reality, it becomes cringy. So it seems so minor. It seems like, oh, this is just a semantic issue. No, it's a massive issue because the chasm between I find it cringy and it becomes cringy is like this huge, giant, you know, Grand Canyon wide difference in how we're going to be received. When MTL 13 says it becomes cringy, what she is inferring silently and very likely unconsciously is that she is an objective arbiter of reality and she has the authority to make these grand proclamations about Emily's speech patterns, about reality at large. So the way that is received very often is by people thinking that whoever is projecting their judgment as an objective assessment of reality is an arrogant blowhard. And it's going to create a lot of contraction, a lot of defensiveness, and a lot of unflattering feelings and opinions of assessment of he who is doing the, projecting their judgments as an objective assessment of reality. Because the implication, and again, this is all happening in the subconscious mind, but let us remember the subconscious mind is responsible for 99% of our experience of reality. So it is transmitting the communication that whomever is judging is like the almighty emperor of reality, and that their word is how it is, and that this person's assessment that Emily's likes are cringy or have become cringy is the objective experience of Emily's likes versus this person's own unique individual experience. And I'm telling you, this subtle shift is the difference between an argument, a crappy comment made back, or feelings of ill will, or like, this is not someone who I really want to spend time getting to know because this person's a jerk. This person's communicating like a jerk. So I want to read us. So judgment is one of the categories of wrong use of will languaging that I write about in my book and that we can all recognize, you know, start to recognize as hierarchical languaging and as a means of creating resentment and of further fragmenting our populace because it just doesn't engender feelings of safety, trust, respect, or, good friendliness among us. So I guess we don't need to be doing the screen share that much longer. All right, coming back, gifting myself a sip. Okay. Judgment. When we judge, we separate. We don't just separate, we attempt to diminish the other's status. They're not just not us, they are beneath us. The act of judgment kicks that which or whom we are judging down a notch or two or 12. Their status plummets through the lens of our judgment. It's hierarchy agogo. Judgment alleges that we are objective arbiters of capital T truth and are divinely authorized to project our opinions as facts. Judgment implies that we hold superior knowledge that something is bad, that someone is immoral, that an object is overpriced, that a garment is ugly, or that yesterday's workshop sucked. When we judge, we project our unintegrated traumas, distortions, wounds, shadows, and programs onto that which we are judging, while unconsciously claiming omniscience and impartial, almighty decider status that gives us license to smear our opinions all over the world at large. Now, I go into polarities here because some of the simplest judgments for us to reference are good, bad, right, wrong, pretty, ugly, better, worse. And in this section of the book, I'm referencing bits that I spoke about before, so I'm not going to read directly. But the example I want to give about polarities is, you know, I talk a lot about Brett and Eric Weinstein, especially in my podcast that I do with Emily. And something that they're both prone to saying a lot is, well, that's wrong thinking, or that's right thinking. And, you know, as I've examined over the years, like, what is it about these guys that trigger me? What is it about these guys that doesn't land well? And it is a long, lengthy list. And it's these objective assessments that they so arrogantly project onto ways of thinking, onto ideas, and the inferred allegation from there that they have some sort of omniscient, almighty judgment status that gives them license to project their own opinions onto the world at large as objective fact. So I want to give us the polarity piece just so we have it, just so we, you know, it's just kind of helps us understand how these communication patterns are sabotaging us. And it really, like, yes, of course, like, I certainly hold myself to higher standards of communication, to honor others, to respect others, to make it so that my communications can be absorbed by others. But, you know, it's also so we can not waste our time. Like, what is the point of me going to, you know, driving all the way to Texas to give an hour-long talk if during that talk I'm using words and phrases that are shutting down my audience and having them armor up and close themselves off to my ideas? Like, it doesn't serve me, it doesn't serve my audience. As I said, most of the time, I'd say 99.999% of the time that speakers are shutting down their audience, they have no idea. But still, they're wasting their time. It's not effective, it's not efficient. They're not having the impact that they could have because they're using language that's coded with these power struggles, right? And so when the audience is armoring up, don't tell me what to do, you don't have, you know, any agency over me, there's not a lot of space for the meat of the message to land. So I'm sharing these with you because these are superhero tools that allow your message to land more easily. Think how small, you know, most people's attention span is in light of, you know, a screen addicted culture. Very often, you know, we have, you know, 5-10 seconds max to say something that's going to grab someone and get their attention. We don't want to be wasting those opportunities by using wrong use of will languaging that's going to shut down whomever I'm speaking to. If I'm talking to someone in line at some big conference and they say, you know, you should be trading with Cordle, and you should sell your Ethereum, and you should do this and that, like, my system is not going to hear their well-intended advice amidst all those shoulds, which are activating my amygdala, which is thereby going to be releasing hormones that armor me up, so I literally can't even hear their good advice because of the wrong use of will languaging embedded in the should. So these are tools that are going to allow you to be heard, to have the impact you want to have, as well as to make our relationships infinitely more harmonious. You know, if I'm having a conversation with a partner and I say, you know, let's say I'm having this conversation with Emily, you know, and Emily, she's super, super emotionally intelligent. But if I say to Emily, you know, you should really slow your roll on those likes, let's switch roles. If Emily is telling me, Danny, you really should slow your roll on those likes, they're super cringe. Is that conversation going to go well? Probably not, because the way I'm wired, that was so much judgment and her, you know, crossing the line and telling me what to do that I could very well, you know, pop off back with something snotty that's not going to be constructive or conducive to like an Emily Danny podcast meeting, right? However, if I take ownership and I say, hey, babe, I noticed that sometimes when you're using a lot of likes in our podcast, I can kind of tune out or like lose track of what we're even talking about. So, you know, for me, like I find it easier to stay engaged in our conversations when there are fewer likes, right? So in that instance, and let's be clear, I don't have an issue with these types of linguistic tics that I myself am still in the process of relinquishing. But the difference is in me taking ownership of my experience and not projecting it as an objective judgment, which will likely, you know, have whomever I'm speaking to contract, feel unsafe, feel embarrassed, not necessarily be open to my feedback. Right? And anyone who's in a long-term partnership, has healthy, you know, conscious relationships will know there that the I statements and the owning our experiences as our experiences and not conflating them with objective assessments of reality is the biggest gift you can give to your relationships. Honestly, I think in terms of like, you know, and I obviously I'm not a fan of hierarchy or creating some sort of hierarchical list of these tools, and that is one of the most valuable things you could do for your every relationship is own your experience with I statements and not project judgments onto other people. And going back to the polarities, the good, bad, the right, wrong, which are, you know, those are also judgments. All right, so this is where we're going to end part one, the public portion of today's podcast. I'm going to pick up the last part of wrong use of will languaging, as well as some bonus, my bonus 2 cents on the state of the current abortion conversation in this country on my Patreon and my Locals pages, where my supporters get access to all of my second half conversations, my post-show throwdowns, which are the bonus videos that I do on the flip side of my solo podcast. You can find those at dannycatz.locals.com, as well as on patreon.com/DannyKatz. As you're interested in learning more about my work, my books, my courses, my webinars, how you can work with me one-on-one in a coaching capacity or bring me into your organization as a consultant, you can learn more about me at DannyKatz.com, as well as quantumlanguaging.com. Lastly, I'm inviting you to sign up for my newsletter at DannyKatz.com, because given the massive array of big tech thought policing and censorship shenanigans, it is the very best way to ensure that we get to stay in touch. All right, that does it. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. Have a rockin' day.
And for clicking that subscribe button, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, and for leaving some kind words as a review, as you are authentically inspired, as you are receiving any value from my podcast, as you dig it, as you listen regularly, consider supporting me on Patreon and or Locals, where for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half podcast interviews, as well as oodles of bonus content. Your support really goes a long way in supporting me as a journalist and an independent content creator navigate her way through a really crunchy time in terms of free speech. And as you are wanting to learn more about my work in the world, my books, my products, my quantum languaging coaching and consulting, you can find me at DannyKatz.com. as well as quantumlanguaging.com. And if you're not down with a membership patronage platform and want to send me one-time donation, You can use the Bitcoin link if it actually appears on your podcast listening platform. You could also send me a one-time donation by way of PayPal at dannykatz@pm.me or by way of Venmo, where my username is Sadie Bloom. Again, your support means the world and makes a massive, massive difference when it comes to continuing to share this work with the world. Thank you for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that you are omniscopic amazingness and for having a rockin' day. See you next time, superstars.